Welcome to the Global Heart Podcast. I'm your host, Pablo Perel, Senior Science Advisor at the World Heart Federation. Today, we have a very special episode addressed to a general audience, including people living with heart failure, family members and caregivers, and anyone who wants to understand what heart failure is, how it's diagnosed, and in particular, how to better navigate the interaction between people living with heart failure and their healthcare team. I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Gillian Coate and Dr. Wagner Madrini to talk about heart failure both from a patient and physician perspective. Gillian is a researcher and educator from University of British Columbia, Canada, and a heart failure survivor herself, having received two heart transplants. She's the author of a recent paper that summarized in plain language many important things about heart failure, and I'm sure it will help both patients and their caregivers, and we include a link of this paper below the podcast that I recommend our audience to read. Wagner is a cardiologist and deputy editor of Global Heart Journal. He's from São Paulo, Brazil, and he specializes in heart failure. Gillian Wagner, welcome to the Global Heart Podcast. So, I would like to start with you, Gillian, and you have a very long heart failure journey, and we'll learn more about it. But I would like to know, when you first heard the word heart failure, what did you think it meant, and what was your reaction?
Thank you, Pablo, and thank you to the World Heart Federation for having me on the podcast today, and to Wagner. Looking forward to this conversation. The words heart failure, really, I was confused, honestly. I didn't know what they meant, and what its broader implications were. I was very sick when I was being told that this is what I had. And so I was honestly, at the time, I was relieved that there was a name for what it was that I had, and that the team around me, the doctors, the nurses, everybody seemed to know what to do. And so at that point, there was relief, but then also confusion because I had never had anything wrong with my heart before. And it was what's I was confused. And what do you mean, heart? And then also failure. And having those words together, it just didn't make sense. I was completely confused and in cognitive dissonance.
Thank you, Gillian. And we'll come back and all the time during this conversation to some of your recommendations to improve the communication. And I think you have really useful tools in your paper about how to do. But is there any concrete recommendation regarding how to name it and the first, particularly the first time that you named this to someone with heart failure that you think it could improve the way, I mean, healthcare providers interact with patients?
Yeah, well, that's a really great question because there's a lot of controversy, as I'm sure you're well aware, around the more colloquial term, which is heart failure, and then a lot of the underlying conditions, which many patients, when they're diagnosed, that's often what they hear. And then the words heart failure come in at some point in their journeys. And to understand the severity of what's happening to you, I can't see the two words that are more appropriate, in terms of heart and failure, because that really drives home the point. That's what's happening, what you're in right now, what's happening to you is just that. The thing that I think is really important for people to understand, at least from what I've learned, is that heart failure is really a verb, right? So it's something like it's an action. It's what you're currently in, but you can come out of, and that you can stabilize, and that your heart can be, maybe not what it was before, or whatever, but that it can be stable, and you can live very well that way, and you can live long that way. It's just the point is that we want to keep you out of this danger zone that is heart failure. So the words, I think, should really be something akin to or close to heart function. And when your heart function is affected, And I'm sure Wagner will speak at length about this more knowledgeably than I can from the medical side, that it is, that your heart function can be impacted throughout your journey. And we want to keep you out of that danger zone, which is what we, are now calling heart failure. So I'm not 100% sure what the right words would be, but if we talk about how your heart is functioning, I think that lessens the 0 to 100 effect of bringing in the words heart failure right away, but that we want to keep you out of it. So we want to keep your heart functioning as well as it can, because the underlying muscle, for some whatever reason, has been affected. That's what I've learned, and that's what I understand it to be, and that's where I personally feel the most comfort with that phrase.
Thank you, Gillian. In any case, I think the importance of words, and sometimes as healthcare providers, we forget about that. We think about the technical term and not the impact that words might have. Moving to you, Wagner, and Gillian already mentioned a little bit what is heart failure, but can you, and I know it's a tough question, to briefly explain what is heart failure and the causes and some of the common symptoms in a few words. Can you share with us those key concepts?
First of all, thank you for having me, Pablo, and thank you for the WHF for this special episode. I guess having Jillian here is so amazing because, especially, I think sometimes we physicians, we are so focused on clinical trials, endpoints, trying to find new medication treatments to treat our patient better. But sometimes we forget the patient's perspective that we ultimately is what is most important. So thank you for this opportunity to be here with all of you. And thank you for the WHF and you, Pablo. So briefly, talking about heart failure is a tough mission, but I guess if trying to make it simple, if we think of heart as a pump, heart failure means that the heart is not working as an efficient pump. And the heart basically have two functions, one to receive blood, another one to distribute blood for the rest of the body. So if we have a problem in one of those two functions, we might have heart failure. So if I have problems to receive blood, we're gonna call as heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. If we have a problem to distribute blood, to pump the blood forwards, we're gonna call what we have heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. Basically, those two functions. And yeah, there are many causes of heart failure: valve disease, arrhythmias, myocarditis, cardiomyopathy. But globally, the two most important causes are coronary artery disease and high blood pressure. And why is it important? It's really important because those two main causes correspond about 50 to 60% of all causes of heart failure worldwide. And those two diseases are kind of sort of preventable or treatable, so if I control blood pressure well and prevent heart attacks, I might reduce a burden of heart failure. So I'm mentioning that because I know Pablo is involved with a lot of projects, programs with WHF to treat better hypertension and primary prevention. So if we could do this job well, treat hypertension and prevent heart failure, we might avoid a really a burden of heart failure. So those are the cause. And you asked, and you also asked about the common symptoms. So we got a bunch of symptoms, but I like to think about two categories of symptoms. One related to symptoms of congestion, which means a fluid overload, fluid retention, that basically is shortness of breath, waking up breathless at night, leg swelling, weight gain, And you have symptoms related to low perfusion, really that kind of means that the heart is not pumping enough blood in a basic way, I mean. So we have a dizziness, low blood pressure, cold extremities, worsening of kidney function. So those are the most common symptoms.
Thank you, Wagner. And I think that was really useful. I would say part of the complexity of heart failure is not only that it can be caused for by many different conditions, but also you have different ways of categorizing, and depending on that, different treatments, which it makes complex for doctors, and I'm sure, of course, much more for people living with this condition. One thing that we were talking just now is about symptoms, and I would like to go back to you, Chilean. If you can share with us what was the beginning of this journey. I mean, how did it start? What were the first symptoms that you thought something isn't right?
Thank you, Pablo. The beginning of my journey is really, I think, one that I have also come to learn is fairly common. In that, my first episode, my first anything, and I was in the hospital right away. And I was misdiagnosed in the emergency room, which is also unfortunately very common. What happened was I was out with my husband and some friends, and we were having dinner and had a glass of wine. And then I just suddenly felt very lightheaded, and I'd had a glass of wine, so I figured that was it. So I went and laid down, but then all of a sudden I had this burning in my chest, thinking it's heartburn or something like that, but it just kept getting worse and worse, and I could feel my heart just really beating, and I could feel it and I could hear it, but this burning sensation, which was what was really strange for me, and I started to have a really hard time breathing. And I was laying down, and I was my husband and friends, they were in another room having conversation, and I was just thinking, well, what is this? And eventually I did get up, and I went, and they looked at me, and they were just like, what is going on? And so we went to emergency, and it was just really, I felt like I was passing out the whole time. They tried to take my blood pressure, but it wouldn't register on the machine. And they're just like, okay, well, we don't know what this is. And it was a busy Saturday night in a metropolitan university hospital. So they just said, okay, well, let's just put you in this room. They did a chest X-ray and everything like that, and decided after many hours being in emergency that what I had was pneumonia. And so they gave me steroid puffer, and sent me home. It progressively got worse, no surprise, that despite being on antibiotics as well as this steroid, that I increasingly couldn't, I couldn't breathe. Eventually I was sitting up, straight up in a chair, trying to sleep. Insert at the same time we were moving, so there was a lot of things that were happening. But what happened then was, this was out after 3 weeks, and then we got to our new home, and I took three steps up the driveway and I collapsed. And I couldn't, like, there was nothing in me. All my limbs were screaming, for oxygen, and I was done. And so we went to emergency again, and a different one, and it took them 3 more days. And I will mention at the time I was 27, turning 28, so I was t 28 years old, a young woman showing up in emergency. And so they think, at that time, this is again 20 years ago, they still, they weren't thinking this heart. That was the last thing probably on any of the physicians' minds, and they were just thinking of the symptoms. I was coughing a lot because I was congested, and I walked in, I was wheeled into the emergency room, and said, well, this is what the other doctors had said, and they continued on with that diagnosis. And so, but once I finally got an echocardiogram, that's when things really started to happen. And so, but the symptoms for me initially were this burning, breathlessness, extreme fatigue, and yeah, and I felt like I was drowning. And I don't know if anybody can understand that feeling. I'm sure patients listening, people with lived experience listening can understand that, but that's what it really felt like for me before I got treatment, was that I was drowning and I couldn't breathe, and I couldn't walk two or three steps without being able to without just feeling absolute exhaustion. And so, the beginning of my journey was very dramatic. And so, but I think there's elements of it that are unfortunately common, when younger people under the age of 40, let's say, get diagnosed, that it is a process. And I wrote another paper about the diagnostic process and how long it takes, and that you need to, try just to be proactive and engage in that. But yeah, so it was very dramatic initial start.
That was, I mean, I can imagine, really tough, really tough, and as you said, I mean, dramatic. And heart failure can, I mean, on one hand, it's a chronic condition, but it can be acute as well, how it presents, or you have relapses. So maybe going to you, Wagner, and maybe not to focus on the acute presentation, that of course it's, as Gillian said, particularly if you're not expecting that in a young woman, it's quite, I mean, common maybe to miss. But why is diagnosing heart failure quite challenging in itself, in general? What would you say? What did make it so sometimes difficult to make the right diagnosis and a timely diagnosis?
I guess the main challenge, I guess, is that there's no specific symptom for heart failure. There's no one symptom that fits at all. So sometimes the patient telling us that the fatigue, shortness of breath, leg swelling, those are kind of very common symptoms. For example, imagine if a patient comes to your office, probably 7 years old patients, telling you, "Okay, I'm a little bit tired. I'm not practicing my physical activity as I used to. My legs are a bit swelling." So, it's kind of tricky because sometimes we feel tired too. We feel some of those symptoms. So sometimes it's tricky because of that. There's no specific symptoms. That's why I guess to think in a kind of diagnosis pathway, I guess, is important. And the first thing, we have to perform a good clinical evaluation, really listen to our patient, li really listen to the story, trying to understand their symptoms, trying to look for the signs of hypervolemia, fluid retention, thinking about those symptoms. Of course, perform a good physical exam. But I guess if we could kind of establish some steps, I guess the first one is a really careful clinical evaluation. Second one, nowadays, we can perform a really quick and easy blood test. It was NT-proBNP that really help us to identify cardiac congestion. So if that's elevated, we can move forward to the next step, that was asking for the echocardiogram, that we can assess the structure and function of the heart and understand and maybe finally confirm the diagnosis, because you have the chamber size, we have the ejection fraction. We can see the diastolic function. So we can establish it and confirm this diagnosis. And then we can investigate the underlying cause. So if we are trying to not make this experience that Julian mentioned us, I guess the best way is trying to first clinical evaluation, second one, to ask for an easy test, easy blood test, NT-proBNP, if it's high, with third, echocardiogram. And the fourth, we can try to understand what was the cause of the heart failure. But if we do this pathway, I guess we can reduce the misdiagnosis, especially in this case that Julian mentioned.
Thank you, Wagner. And I think beyond, of course, all the more technical aspects, I think you mentioned a few things that for me, even if they are simple, but they're so important, that is to take the time. And that sometimes, I mean, the doctors do not have the time or do not take the time to do a proper physical examination and to listen to the patient and to think about heart failure. No, I mean, those are kind of, they're not kind of rocket science, but those are key things. It's not straightforward, but you need to think about heart failure and take the time and listen. So going back to you, Gillian, you mentioned that dramatic diagnosis, and that was, you said, many couple of decades ago now. So can you tell us again, I mean, briefly, how that journey continued, maybe some highlights that you want to share with us of that journey since your diagnosis?
Sure. Yes, the after the dramatic entry that I made into this heart failure journey, once I was stabilized in hospital, I was sent to a clinic that specialized in advanced heart failure and transplant. At the initially, while I was in hospital, there were, they did say the word transplant because it was so very serious what my heart was. Essentially functioning at around 15% ejection fraction, less than that, and it was full of clots, and so there was a lot of challenges. But I am fortunate that I did get connected with the appropriate doctors who understood heart failure intimately, and I was stabilized with medical management. So I was on a beta blocker, and I was on some other medications. The beta blocker is the one that comes to mind because it's the one that gave me the most. I was already tired, but it makes you feel even more tired while you're trying to get adjusted to it. But once I was under good medical management, or on good medical management medications, my journey was thankfully, I was able to return to somewhat of a normal life. I had started my PhD program. I was supposed to start this when I got sick. It was the summer before I started my PhD program. And so they initially said, maybe you shouldn't do that. And my husband and I are just like, no, maybe I should. And so I just kind of continued on and made adjustments to my life, understanding that if I'm tired, I rest, and knowing what the symptoms were. Anytime anything changed, I connected with my team, and there was a nurse, a heart failure nurse specifically, and so I continued on. I did get I stayed out of hospital for the most part, which is, I'm very grateful for. And I got my PhD, and I went on to do my postdoc at Harvard. And it was just before this time that I got a that I had a stroke, and which surprised everyone. I'll spare you all of the details of that fun diagnostic process, but the essence of it was that my heart had decompensated, so I had, gone back into heart failure. And so, even with, the good medical management at the time, my heart still slowly got worse. So to Wagner's point, that it was chronic, and that was one thing that I think was hard for me to understand initially, was this idea that heart failure is a chronic, or that the heart failure is now managed, I think, more as a chronic condition, and that it can be stable for a long period of time, but you can also undergo a steady decline, which is what happened to me. And so I did stay out of hospital, but I did progressively get worse. And so when I had that stroke, that was when we decided that my EF had gone up, but it and had now started to go back down. It was up close to 30%, and so it was deemed at that time that I should probably have an ICD implanted. And so that was I had that, and then everything went very well, and it wasn't until summer of 2013 that I really just felt like I was walking through mud. And my legs were swelling, and I was having a hard time breathing. Even more, those were also subtle. But what really got me at this point, and I want to highlight this because this is also, I think, an underused recognition, that I was starting to have more cognitive issues. And so as an academic, I'm sure you can appreciate that not being able to concentrate, not being able to, to read a paper or anything like that, and it was just very difficult. My memory was going. My memory's still not the best now, but that's for other reasons, I think. But yeah, so it was very, very, I was still young. I was 33-ish at the time. So, and that was something that really sprung my team into action with respect to, okay, well, now you're on all of the best medications at the time. You're well managed. I've been titrated up. And Vagner will probably talk about this as well, about medical management. And that was the time when they said, okay, well, it's time to be evaluated for transplant. And so that's when I went through that process. And then, yeah, and so over the 5 years, kind of from that point forward, I don't shy away from being dramatic, apparently. That's kind of what I do now in my life. And that I had ended up, once I was listed for transplant, I had an emergency LVAD in 2014, and March of 2014, and then by October of 2014, I was given the gift of my first of transplant, and saved my life. The recovery from that was also a very intense process. Actually, I'll mention right here, if I may, because my journey is so long, people tell me I could write a book. I did write a blog throughout this process. So while I was going through all of this, it's called heartfailuretoharvard.com. And so I don't know if you want to add that to the resources, but I do speak about these varying aspects of diagnosis and what it was like for me emotionally, mentally, creatively, all of those things at that time, because it was difficult, and it's hard to find words to express all of this. And then following that, I did unfortunately lose that first heart, but then I was gifted with a second transplant, and I've been very stable ever since. And so yeah, so it's been a long journey, and there's a lot of intricacies and nuances to that, but those were the highlights, if you like.
Thank you, Gillian. And definitely, we will include that link for your blog. I think is a very definitely tough journey, but also an inspiring journey for many people, I'm sure. And I think it's something that I'm sure people living with heart failure and many other conditions might want to read and inspire. Let's we'll go back to some of practical tools and recommendations at the end, but Gillian mentioned briefly Wagner on the idea of medication. I mean, how we need to increase medication and adjust medication. That's part of the management of heart failure, and also a lot of things that are about lifestyle advice. And this question I would like, because I know in your paper, Gillian, you talk about this, but also, and I want both of you to say how, Wagner, in your practice, how you do it or how you think doctors should do it to communicate this to patients with heart failure. So the medical increase and the lifestyle, and then maybe, Gillian, you can also comment on some of your messages in your paper on how to improve this communication. So first to you, Wagner.
Yeah, actually, this is a really important topic when we speak about heart failure, because many people kind of assume that more medications means that their condition is worsening, they're not doing good, you know. But specifically in heart failure, and especially for reduced ejection fraction, that's not how it works, you know. Because from the very first beginning, regardless how mild or even severe your symptoms are, we need at least four core medications, you know, and not because the patient is worse, not because the patient is good, no, just because this disease in heart failure, we usually activate some harmful neurohormonal pathways at the same time, and each medication will block a different pathway. That will maybe, if you not do that, it will come as a progression of heart failure. So each medication, there's a specific hole. That's why it doesn't mean that you're worse or not. There's actually adding or increasing medication is not a sign of failure here. Actually, it's a strategy to protect the heart and protect to block those harmful neurohormonal pathways that are activated in heart failure. And this type of medication is really important, especially because I don't know if all of you are familiar with that, but the leading cause of heart failure hospitalization worldwide is not an infection, it's not an arrhythmia, it's not a heart attack. No, it's a poor medication adherence. It's because the patient is not taking properly their medication. It's the main cause of heart failure hospitalization. And I use it to look at this data, thinking, oh my God, what's happening in my nursery? About 50% of my patients are hospitalized because they are not taking medication, thinking that maybe it could be something that patients were kind of careless. And took me years to understand actually that's a physician communication problem. If we don't explain clearly to our patient which each medication matters, of course the patient not taking. Oh, if you just take the patient and say, okay, you have heart failure and now you have to take those four medications and see you later, definitely the patient will not take those medications. So it's much more this main cause of heart failure hospitalization. It's much more about us physician and trying to improve our communication than a patient, because we have to explain how those medications matter, how it reduce hospitalization, how it will might improve survival, how it will help those people live better and longer, and kind of we have to motivate them to take those medications. So education, I guess, change adherence. You know pretty much well, probably you're involved with a lot of programs of that. But education, especially in heart failure, is too important because of it. Of course, there's a lot of different holes, a lot of different variables in that process. But one, I guess, very much important is the physician explain why the patient have to take those four, five, six medications to get better, and how it's going to reduce hospitalization and even improve their survival and help them to live better and longer.
Thank you. Thank you, Wagner. And I do agree. And I think there's still a lot of, in the medical literature, in the medical discussions, a lot of blaming, as say, patients do not are not compliant with the recommendations. So, like a paternalistic approach. But I would say for me, it's more a failure of that interaction between healthcare providers and patients, both. And I think we need to improve that communication. We don't spend enough time. And I know that this is something in your paper, you put some thinking, Gillian. So, what do you think would be important? Maybe you can start with concretely with the question I asked to Wagner in terms of how to explain the issue of medication titration from the beginning. I don't know how you think this should be discussed. And maybe more broadly, I think you have a really nice figure. I think it's figure 7 of your paper that you talk about the barriers in communication. So if maybe you can summarize two or three things that can help, particularly from the patient perspective, to feel more empowered in a consultation. I think I asked you a few things, so let's start maybe with the first one is this communication of the medication adjustment. What's your experience? How you think that could be improved from someone who received that recommendation? What you can say to healthcare providers?
Thank you, Pablo. Absolutely. I think what Wagner touched on was really important, and that the education and the understanding of what it is that you're why you're taking the medication, and first that heart failure is very complex, and that it isn't, if you're getting worse, or if you're more symptomatic, or all of these things, that it's not your fault, right? That you're not being blamed for anything. It's just I would say in many cases a natural progression of the disease and the underlying condition. And Wagner and the physicians are there to try and fight that process. And in order to do that, you need to take these medication. And so what the medications are, what they do for your body and what they do for your heart, really understanding that is key. And one individual that I want to bring into the conversation here is this, our physicians often have, only a few minutes of time with every patient. So if there's a heart failure nurse you can speak to and have this conversation, but also pharmacists. Pharmacists in the community or they're part of the hospital or wherever they are, they know everything of, if they don't know everything about a medication, they'll know how to find everything about a medication. So they can certainly help explain some more of those details. And so I think that is really something important to keep in mind. And that one of the barriers I think that contributes is that there isn't often a multidisciplinary team who can provide all of those different perspectives, that we rely 100% on the physician who is also stretched and looking after hundreds, if not thousands, of patients. You have to think of that. And so leaning on some of those other people, I think, is really important. And we do touch on that in, I think, in the paper. But if you have any questions about anything, always just keep asking those questions. The other thing that for me, I think would have been really helpful for me to really understand is that when you're taking the medication, the medications also have side effects. And so those side effects, I would say, are often what may prevent somebody from actually taking them. And the one I spoke of it earlier, and I kind of laugh at myself now, but it's really true, is the beta blocker. It ends in LOL or LOL or, and those medications really slow your heart down and even more than it already is. And so sometimes the side effects can't be overcome, but in many cases they can. And so I would encourage people just to, when they're taking the medication, please take it, first of all. And then when you are, give it some time to do its work. It will take, a few weeks, if not a couple of months, before it really settles into place. And that's where I really would like to emphasize. And so that there's the communication barriers that happen, there's the barriers that you're already symptomatic from heart failure, but now you're symptomatic for other things and you're not sure if that's heart failure that you're feeling or if it's because of the medication, and then just trying to overcome all of that is really tough.
Thank you, Gillian. And you mentioned, I think we'll be closing now, but you mentioned one really important, I mean, many important things, but one that I want to highlight that is don't be afraid of asking questions. That's something that at the end of the day, you are the most important person as a patient, and you have the right to ask questions. And you have, and again, to our audience, I recommend in your paper, you have a list of questions that patients can ask to think in advance. And anyone who is a patient knows that it's good to think in advance some questions because at the moment maybe they don't come to you. So I think that's a really useful resource. We again, I will put the link to the blog to the paper below the podcast. I would like to end maybe asking you, Gillian. You face so many challenges in this difficult journey, and imagine that you're talking with someone who is starting that journey, and it feels so, I can imagine, overwhelming and difficult. What would you say to this person?
I would say, once you've under if you understand your condition, even if you don't, you're trying to prepare for appointments, you don't know how to do that, you have all of these questions. One of the things that and the reason why my we Mark Baines and I started the HeartLife Foundation. It was really at its essence, at its core, was to connect with other patients. And so finding a group in your own, whether it's a face-to-face group, whether it's an online group, there's many, many of them out there. And talking with other people who are living a similar journey to yours, they can offer you comfort, at least in the knowledge that you're not alone in this journey. There's millions and millions of people around the world who are suffering with this condition, and so you're definitely not alone in that. And doing that, either through HeartLife, going on our website, or going to World Heart Federation, looking up heart failure organizations in your own area, I think is really important. Because with that, with that and with education, we also have I spoke about my blog earlier, but I also have there's a film called My Broken Heart that was made about that journey. So I often share that about I tell patients or people with lived experience. I said, when you're ready, because it's more about the end stage, like the advanced aspect of heart failure. And it's very intense, but it is freely available. And so doing all of these things, educating yourself, preparing for your appointments, understanding your condition, that really it empowers you. And through that empowerment, you take back some of what this condition has taken from you, and that's your own agency to live the life that you want to lead. But by doing these very simple things, you can take some of that back, and you can live a really good quality of life if you do.
Thank you, Gillian. And I'm not sure if those resources are translated into Portuguese, but I'm sure if not, maybe Wagner, they're really useful resources, and maybe the society in Brazil have similar resources, but definitely if not worth exploring that. I want to thank you both, Gillian and Wagner, for it was a really interesting
Thank
conversation.
you.
Thank you.
I hope it was useful for our audience, and I'm sure it was for both the clinical and the lived experience side. It was really, really useful to our listeners. As I mentioned, we include a link to the paper below the podcast, and please share it with someone who might benefit, and subscribe to the Global Heart Podcast for more conversations about heart and health. Until next time, thanks for listening.